Is it peace in Lebanon? Is it war in Syria? Is France governable? We'll look at all of these questions along with all the top stories from the week in today's Trumpet Hour. Hello and welcome to our special live edition of our Trumpet Hour Week in Review. This is the first time that we have ever, I think, done a Trumpet Week in Review show live, or at least the whole thing. We tried part of it live, Mihailo and I, last week. So a bit of an experiment. It means no do-overs. We can't fix our mistakes, at least not for you watching it live. For those of you watching pre-recorded or watching this later, I guess, for all you know, maybe we did cover up a few flubs. I don't think we're planning on doing that. But, yep, we're up live without the safety net. My name is Richard Palmer, Assistant Managing Editor at thetrumpet.com. I'm joined by our panel of other Trumpet staff writers. If you do have any questions for us, I have the various different live chat boxes right here from YouTube, from Rumble, from Twitter or X or whatever it's called now. So if you do have anything you want to ask us as we go through this, you can feel free to pop something on there. I see we've already got a good morning from one of our listeners on YouTube, and I can always pitch those out to the appropriate panelist. Well, war and peace is the subject of the first section that we're going to get into, not Tolstoy, but two big changes coming from the Middle East. We'll start with the most recent, very much a breaking story. The Syrian civil war used to be one of these subjects that we were covering every single week on Trumpet Hour. Now it's been quiet for about 4 years, subject to a truce between most of the parties. Then on Wednesday, it all exploded again. And so our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic, is here to tell us more about that.
Yes, on Wednesday, one of the rebel groups, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, a.k.a. al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, launched an offensive against the Syrian army, that is the actual Syrian army controlled by President Bashar al-Assad, in the province of Idlib, in the northwest corner of Syria. This is the first major action that any one of these groups has taken since 2020 truce, as you've mentioned. And since Wednesday, they've covered a lot of ground. On Wednesday itself, they seized 19 villages and military sites all in that northwestern area. They made it to the outskirts of Aleppo, that's Syria's second largest city that a few years ago was really notorious for how much it became rubble under a Russian bombardment on behalf of the Syrians. And then just as we were preparing this program now, news broke out that the al-Qaeda group has actually entered Aleppo itself and is currently battling control for the city with the Syrian army.
So I was writing some of this up for the Trumpet Morning Brief. So I've looked into this somewhat. You've got into this in much more detail. So first of all, from what I read, because I think a lot of the big immediate question is why now? Like, why did this explode from nowhere? One of the points that I read is this is to do with Iran is Bashar al-Assad's big patron. They did a lot to prop him up. Hezbollah did a lot to prop him up. And that Iran and Hezbollah are kind of preoccupied fighting Israel, or in Hezbollah's case, being dismantled by Israel. And that you had these Sunni anti-Iranian groups backed by al-Qaeda kind of working away in the background and planning this attack, which then they just kind of launched completely by surprise on Wednesday. Is that what you've gotten looking into this in more detail?
Well, there's obviously a lot of information flowing around there. It's a bit hard to put every piece of the puzzle together. But for the most part, I think the fact that this happened on the exact same day that the ceasefire with Lebanon, which we'll get to a little bit later in this program, happened, isn't a coincidence. Huh. But with that being said, according to first off, it's not just this al-Qaeda group that's attacking. There's also some elements affiliated with the Syrian National Army, which is the name of the rebel group that's basically a proxy of Turkey there in northern Syria. Not all of them are fighting, but some of them are. And according to a Turkish source that spoke with Middle East Eye, this was actually being planned in advance for a while, and Turkey got wind of it and have been trying to pressure them not to go ahead with this. And again, most of Turkey's proxies aren't involved with this, but some of them are, and looks like they're discarding what President Erdogan there wants. And for like Hayat Tahrir al-Sham's part, they are a bit affiliated with Turkey as well, though in a bit more of an arm's length aspect than, say, some of these other groups.
So Syrian National Army, like, just back when we were covering, I'm trying to dig out memories from 10 years ago when all of this was going on with the Syrian civil war. Were they the ones that were supposed to be the kind of the good guys, the ones that America was willing to support because they were against Assad, but they were not too close to al-Qaeda?
One of the groups. There's a few other, there's several groups with similar names that it's easy to get confused with them. I think you're talking about, I believe it's the Syrian interim government that was the big one that America was sponsoring. But I mean, obviously Turkey and America are on paper on the same side with the Syrian civil war too. So that obviously has a bit of leech over in this front as well.
And then meanwhile, we've seen Russia get involved. I saw some stories that they've started bombing positions that these rebels have taken.
Within their own territory, like not just the new annexation of, or the new front, but within their what they've been controlling for years now too.
So this is then, from what I've seen, people are saying they're the ones that are largely responsible for the civilian casualties, that the Russians have used typical Russian care about civilians, which is not much, to try and stop these. So, I mean, how serious of a threat is this, do you think, to us? Like, is this, are we back on? Is this a last hurrah for the rebels? What size of a deal is this? What size of attack is this?
Well, considering Aleppo is the second largest city in Syria, it used to be a rebel stronghold back when the civil war was fully raging. And the fact that they were able to get in there so quickly, I think, says a lot. We could put up a map right now that shows a little bit on what situation on the ground in Syria looks like.
Don't know that clarifies things much.
It doesn't, but the red area is government controlled. The green area is this Al-Qaeda group plus Turkey. Yellow area is Kurdish forces that are supported by the U.S. And there's other little groups that control bits of territory here and there, including the Islamic State. As you can see, Syria is a bit of a mess, and this has been the status quo, again, for the last 4 years, and nobody's wanted to disrupt it because nobody was in a position to finish the job, whether it be on Assad or the rebels or the Kurds or whoever. This could very well be the first domino that gets knocked over and gets this whole let's not rock the boat agreement all into shatters. And for Assad's part, there have been, at this point, unverified, but there have been reports that there are mass desertions and switching sides with the Syrian army, with even some leaders in the Druze community saying that if you're Druze, you need to stop, and you're in the army, you need to drop your weapons right now. So how seriously some of these people will take it, whether it'll stay localized in the area or spread throughout the country, we don't know. But it is still, at the very least, it's not an open and shut case for Assad.
What if we could get that map up again, George? This has been in the northwest of the country.
Yeah.
That's where this fighting has been. So is it in kind of, they've been pushing out of those green boundaries up towards the top near the Turkish border?
Exactly. And another little thing with this map, it might be a little confusing with the size, but you see a lot of little dots over there. Those all represent military bases from outside countries. So you could see the red at the north there is Turkey. The one with the green stripe at the top is Iran. Russia's mixed in there too. You could see American bases in the Kurdish area. There's a lot of foreign powers with boots on the ground in Syria right now, with different interests. Some of them align more closely with each other than others, that if anything were to fall apart in Syria, those countries will be getting involved as well.
Yeah, I've heard people say, like, Turkey is never giving those green bits back. They've got it. They put a lot of work into getting those bits. They're not handing them over. So I just wanted to go... The metaphor you used was like falling of dominoes. So if this is the first domino falling, are you saying this is not strong enough or dramatic enough to get rid of Assad by itself, but it could form part of a chain reaction if it gets other groups involved?
Exactly. Well, I mean, that's how the Syrian civil war started, when Assad cracked down on certain protesters in the south of the country, and that just spread throughout the rest of the country. If other groups like the Kurds, for example, like some of those U.S.-supported groups that I mentioned earlier that are more in the south of the country, if they decide, okay, now's our chance, this, we're never going to have a better opportunity than this to go after Assad, we need to join the foray. At this point, there's not much stopping them, unless if Assad acts preemptively, which of course will make everybody mad. And Assad himself, as I mentioned, doesn't really have the capability to stamp this out altogether, as far as the other rebel groups are concerned, just yet. So I think it's almost like a Mexican standoff at this point, where everybody's staring each other in the eye, everybody has their guns loaded, and nobody wants to take the first shot. And you could say almost like the tumbleweed just broke the silence right now.
Somebody just took a shot.
Yeah, well, I guess you could say it too.
So outside powers, you mentioned Turkey is kind of, they have been backing these groups. However, they weren't keen on this, apparently. The Saudis, they've got links, the other Sunni Arab states. Were they keen on this? Is this a case of it's purely the Syrian rebels kicked this off and no outside power wanted to restart things?
They haven't really said as much publicly yet. I don't think, as far as the Saudis would be concerned, with all the overtures they'd be making with the states and Israel and whatnot, it would look too good for them if they all of a sudden started bankrolling Al-Qaeda out of nowhere.
So you think this is just the Syrian rebels themselves?
Syrian rebels themselves, with Turkey's example, the big thing they probably don't want to do is antagonize Russia, with especially everything going on with Ukraine right now, this talk that a peace deal could come in. Russia, of course, is a bit irate for Turkey supporting Ukraine. But with that being said, Erdogan has been known to take advantage of any opportunity he can to mainly stamp out the Kurdish groups, because they, of course, have links with the Kurdish groups in Turkey. And if this is an excuse for him to finally do so, at very least, I wouldn't put it past him.
I wanted to make sure we have time for, this is because we're live. We can't do any, delete those 5 minutes so that we can shrink the show down. So I don't want to let too much go in the first thing. But anything you wanted to cover on this Syria one before we start to move on and bring in Lebanon into this?
Yes, of course. Well, one last thing is whatever happens here is obviously going to impact Europe quite a bit. We haven't seen Europe jump to the bits, so to speak, to get the situation under control yet, probably because they're too afraid to. But if we get a repeat of what we saw in 2014, 2015 with like masses of Syrian refugees coming in, this could very well be another domino for that to happen. And you can expect, especially countries like Greece and Cyprus that are on the doorstep, you could expect them to start getting more of a, making their voices loud about doing something as well.
Yeah, and we will talk about that more in the Europe section, because I think that ties right in with what I want to talk about there. So other big news is Lebanon, where we had the announcement that Israel and representatives of Hezbollah, I think it wasn't actually Hezbollah itself, have come to a ceasefire agreement. So what can you tell us about that?
Yes, that was supposed to be my main story until the Syria thing blew up in our faces. But on the same day, November 27th, a ceasefire deal, which was announced the day before, came into effect between Israel and officially the Lebanese government, but as you said, really speaking on behalf of Hezbollah. Most of the details have been sort of public knowledge that this is what the different sides were looking for, so we don't have too many surprises. Israel, for its part, has agreed to withdraw from the parts of Lebanon it's occupying within 2 months. Hezbollah is supposed to lay down its arms, the Lebanese armed forces, the official Lebanese army, a bit of a theme that you have, the army of the country and then other armies that, anyway, that's a whole other quagmire. But the official Lebanese army is supposed to come over and dismantle Hezbollah's terrorist infrastructure, confiscate weapons, do a better job monitoring what comes in, what comes out. Hezbollah has a banned military presence, roughly corresponding to the Litani River, which is a very southern route of a river, although Israel got a bit more territory than that than we were expecting. The United States and France have agreed to monitor the agreement, to act as guarantors, and Israel says it reserves the right to act in its own self-defense against Hezbollah if it sees the agreement is not being kept. Which, as of, I believe it was yesterday, Israel said they caught Hezbollah already violating the agreement and fired a strike in there. Now Lebanon is apparently scrambling, the government is, that is, to scrambling to salvage the deal, although I don't think they're going to claim that this is the end of the deal at this point.
Okay, so those are some of the details, what it looks like. What are some of the important takeaways?
Well, for one thing, Hezbollah is pretty whipped. They originally, when they started their bombardment campaign, they said they were going to stop when a ceasefire happened in Gaza.
They backed down on that.
Backed down on that, and also it's interesting with how this is basically a copy of Resolution 1701, which is a United Nations Security Council resolution supposed to stop the 2005 war. And to stop
Hezbollah digging in along the Israeli border, which we're in this situation because that didn't happen.
Yes. I think the big nuggets that Israel taking away from this is now that they have a piece of paper saying that, okay, if you guys do it again, we're going to come in. We have legal justification for doing so. And also there is now an American general on the ground in Lebanon overseeing some sort of monitoring force, which with the Biden administration, some of the choices they made of the peace process, I don't know how effective that's going to be, but it is something that Israel didn't have before. And speaking of monitors, France also is now a member of the agreement as well, which according to reports, their agreement with the deal was that if Israel agreed to this deal, they would drop they wouldn't arrest Benjamin Netanyahu if he visited France. They would ignore the International Criminal Court ruling, which to Emmanuel Macron's credit is a lot better than say what Britain has said or what Spain has said or Canada or a lot of these other Western countries.
Yeah, I want to come back to France. I think the France angle is interesting. Why did they want to be so involved in this? I think to me, what stands out most is that in a lot of ways, Israel was forced into this by a hostile US administration. And I think Carolyn Glick has done a very good job. I don't know. Did you see her video on this yesterday?
I have not.
Yeah, she has a really good 45-minute video. I haven't watched it all yet, but I was looking at that shortly before the show. I'm trying to remember what it's called now. But that's with the JNS. Oh, I've got it right here. So if anyone wants to see more on this in more detail, her video, BB Between Biden and a Hard Place, Carolyn Glick in Focus, is quite a good one for getting some even more in-depth analysis on there. I mean, her take is basically, this isn't really great for Israel, or that there's downsides, but they were kind of forced into this by the United States, and Israel's kind of done about the best that it can do in mitigating a lot of the downsides, and it's the best of a bad situation. I think she mentioned that they were basically blackmailed into this by the Biden administration in a couple of ways. One is that France was reportedly going to have a binding UN Security Council resolution that would force a ceasefire on Israel, and the United States had said that if Israel didn't agree, then the United States would abstain at the UN Security Council, which, pretty interesting rhyme there, given that it was Barack Obama who abstained in the UN Security Council during his kind of awkward time between being voted out of the White House and actually leaving the White House, that set a major precedent there. And now you're having the Biden administration threatening to do the same thing again and allowing this ceasefire to go through. And then also she talked about the arms embargo that has been in place on Israel, and that I thought there have been quite a few good comments on there. Ted Cruz, I should have looked up the sound bites for this. He said he was deeply disturbed by reports that Obama-Biden officials exerted enormous pressure on our Israeli allies to accept the ceasefire. He said that they planned that this administration plans to use Israel's acceptance of this ceasefire to ensure that Hezbollah and other Iranian terrorist groups remain intact across Lebanon and to limit Israel's future freedom of action and self-defense. He accused the Biden administration, rightly, I think, of spending the last 4 years pathologically obsessed with undermining Israel and boosting Iran. So I think it is a product of a hostile government in the United States. And of course, after Benjamin Netanyahu came out and he said, well, the second reason I'm agreeing to this ceasefire is so that I get more weapons, the implication being that that America has not been sending weapons, this Biden administration was like, what? No, there's been no arms embargo. Also, we're just announcing some brand new arms sales to Israel. The United States was trying to starve Israel of weapons to get this through. But on the other hand, I think Netanyahu has done a pretty good job of limiting the impacts. I think in an ideal world, this wouldn't have happened. But he's managed to have this in such a way that it doesn't do Israel as much damage as it might have done. Certainly that the UN a UN resolution would do.
Well, I think the big reason why he's going forward with this now especially is that most of his aims, at least that he's said publicly, for the Lebanon war have been accomplished in terms of...
Right, I think he managed to push off a ceasefire until he'd gotten most of the aims done. And now, you know, he probably knew he'd be forced into this position sooner or later. I mean, this is always Israel's position, even all the way back to the Six-Day War. They're kind of up against the clock, knowing they'd be forced into a ceasefire before they could finish the job properly. And they try and do as much as they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the IDF recently uploaded some statistics as to what they've actually been able to accomplish since the war went into active phase, I guess you could say, in October. Some of this already is well known, but this is some of their statistics. They claim they have 2,500 terrorists or Hezbollah soldiers dead. Hassan Nasrallah and 14 senior leaders, including Fuad Shukr, are dead. 4 division commanders, 24 brigade commanders, 27 battalion commanders, 63 company commanders, and 22 platoon commanders are all now dead. There have been 12,500 Hezbollah targets struck, 1,600 military headquarters, over 1,000 weapons storage facilities, confiscation over 155,000 of thousand weapons and pieces of military equipment, including 12,000 explosive devices, drones, etc., over 13,000 anti-tank missile launchers and rockets and other types of missiles. Over 120,000 communications devices, computers and documents confiscated. They basically, like Netanyahu in his victory speech, said that we've taken Hezbollah back decades, and obviously I'm sure they exist to destroy Israel. They're going to find ways to rearm, but looking at these kinds of numbers, it certainly has looked like Netanyahu has neutered Hezbollah in a way he wasn't able to do so before.
Yeah, I agree. It's been incredible, I think, what they've done to Hezbollah. I think everything Israel's done over the last year has been a testament to all of these things that people said were impossible, were really hard. I mean, we were talking a year ago, and we were both kind of saying it could be a bloodbath when Israel goes into Gaza. The IDF could be losing huge amounts of people. Urban warfare is massively hard. High death tolls, Stalingrad, all of that. That didn't happen. And so I think, yeah, you bold, you step out, you deal with these issues, and actually Israel has done it. You've done a lot. What is kind of agonizing is they have been stopped short of finishing the job. And I think it's easy to sympathize with say, like Israel's internal security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who said an agreement with Lebanon, well, he said it's a big mistake, a historic missed opportunity to eradicate Hezbollah. I understand all the constraints and the reasons, and it is still a grave mistake. Now, I think, again, given all of the situations, the other pressures on Benjamin Netanyahu, he was in a tough situation with limited options and downsides to everything. So I probably wouldn't be quite as quick to say, well, yeah, it's definitely a mistake. But there is a missed opportunity to finish the job here.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I think Netanyahu knew ahead of time what kind of pressure he was going to get.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think he orchestrated everything. Like, you look at how Israel went in. Like,
yeah, I mean, he's made the best of a bad situation. I think we do agree on that.
Well, not just that, but like, I was fully expecting them to go up to Beirut at least a little bit, just if nothing else, in a show of strength. But all the Israeli Defense Forces did was cluster around the border and start dismantling all these, which is, of course, very important. We need to get those people back to in northern Israel, back to their homes. But I always wondered, why weren't they pushing forward? And obviously, public opinion is also another thing that's going racing against Netanyahu. Israel is starting to get a little bit war weary. But personally, with everything that was going on and with the way Netanyahu's been orchestrating everything, I think he's not done with Hezbollah. I think he has other plans, and specifically in with killing Nasrallah and some of these other people, I think his big strategy at this point is leaving Hezbollah so weak that an internal Lebanese group would be available to start a revolution.
That is a good point, that it is not the end. He also said his number one reason for the ceasefire deal was so we could deal with Iran. I have no further comments about that. So there's more, I think, coming on dealing with Hezbollah's patron that is really the key to dealing with Hezbollah. Carolyn Glick pointed out it's a 60-day ceasefire. So her take was kind of like, well, Israel can sign the ceasefire, get more weapons from the United States, and then resume the war against Hezbollah with a friendly White House, with Donald Trump, and with more weapons. So I think that's a possibility. It's not the end of the story there. But Syria and Lebanon, these are two critical Bible prophecies. I mean, these are two prophecies. If you think back on Wednesday's show, Philip Nice and I, we were sitting down in here, and we were talking about the latest Trumpet print edition. And we were, this is full of fulfilled prophecy. That's very clearly on display in the latest Trumpet print, that Mr. Flurry wrote, Donald Trump is going to come back. This seemed very improbable at times. It happened. And so we were talking a lot about yeah, Bible prophecy is real. The Bible you can use to understand world events, but how is that relevant to your life? What do you need to do? And I think that ties into this subject. And we even brought up Lebanon back then, because these are two prophecies also, where Mr. Fleury has said, well, watch for Lebanon to break out of the Iranian orbit. Watch for Syria to switch sides. Like, these are two very similarly improbable stories, maybe even more improbable looking at times over the past decade or so than, say, Donald Trump's return to the White House looked in 2021. It seemed basically impossible for that to happen. I mean, how do you read those two events in light of Bible prophecy?
Well, the go-to prophecy we examine regarding both Lebanon and Syria is in Psalm 83. It speaks of a coalition of various Middle Eastern peoples coming together. Verse 4 states, so that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. Some of these peoples actually, like for example, the Ishmaelites, they don't actually feature that prominently in the biblical narrative as a nation, too many instances. And you certainly can't find a group of all these different peoples coming together in biblical or secular history, whether in this composition or for this particular purpose, which is why Mr. Fleury has pointed to this being a prophecy for now. For our cases, the two there's three places that are mentioned that are of interest to us: the Hagarenes, Gebal, and Tyre. And then you could add as a fourth overarching glue of this alliance is very end, Asher, or the Assyrians, the ancestral peoples of modern Germany. We have plenty of literature on our website that would go into more detail about that. But combining that with other prophecies, like in Daniel 11, verse 40, which speaks of an end-time clash between the forces of radical Islam, which Mr. Fleury has identified as being led by Iran and, by extension, its proxies, and Germany and a united European power, we could put these two prophecies together and see, okay, which countries in the Middle East are going to be allied with Germany, which ones are going to be allied against Germany. The Hagarenes are anciently the inhabitants of Syria, while Gebel and Tyre, or Byblos, the other name of Gebel, ancient Phoenician city-states on Lebanon's coast, are still cities in Lebanon today. And through that, through looking at those prophecies, Mr. Fleury has stated that we can expect Lebanon and Syria at some point to switch sides from Iran, both are proxies of Iran, to Germany, to Europe. And this is probably going to happen well before Iran starts becoming the king of the south, to the point where it's recorded in Daniel, where it starts pushing, where it has all these other countries joining its alliance. And I don't think it's a coincidence we're seeing unrest in these two countries, including in the case of Lebanon, it's like Hezbollah, Iran's lapdog, basically. The pet project has invested probably more than anywhere else, all of a sudden being completely depleted. And that these two forces, again, maybe these are coincidence or not, maybe the Syria offense was timed, but it's still happening at the same time, and we're seeing these two Iranian powers get weakened. And this is what Mr. Fleury wrote in the King of the South booklet regarding Daniel 11, verse 41, which talks about the King of the North entering that specific word into the Holy Land. Quote, the Hebrew indicates this is a peaceful entry, not forced. The Jews appear to invite them in as peacekeepers. After war explodes in the Middle East, there will probably be a thunderous call for peacekeepers in Jerusalem. We commented on this in our November-December issue that maybe that Israel's letting this happen because they see that Europe is having a control over the situation of their other Iranian proxies, like Lebanon, like Syria, that Israel no longer sees those regions as threats. And especially, like you mentioned, with France coming in there, making sure, like, they're putting their foot down and saying, we want a seat at the table.
Yeah, I thought that was that France was even willing to make concessions and say, okay, we won't arrest Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, France has been pretty hostile to Israel this entire war.
France has been hostile to Israel for decades.
I mean, they're not reluctantly being dragged in. They're actively trying to give Israel, like, pay Israel to so that they could be included in this Lebanon deal. They want to be involved in Lebanon. So I think that is really revealing to see Europe saying, we want to be involved in this area.
And even Turkey, like, obviously Turkey flip-flops quite a bit and is really notorious for that, but they're one of the biggest recipients of German arms in the world. They're a member of NATO, have all these links with European militaries. They're connected with Europe, and their effort is too.
But bringing it back to this subject of fulfilled prophecy, I mean, this is from Mr. Fleury's latest article in the Trumpet print. It went to print just last week, up on our website just this week, where he has an article, The Fall and Rise of Lebanon. And he talked about Syria there as well. He said, Syria borders Lebanon. It's also listed in Psalm 83, you know, like you just covered, Mihailo. Dramatic changes are taking place there as well. Iran has had a stranglehold on Syria for years, yet many Syrians really want help from Germany. They want German help to reconstruct their economy and make progress nationally. And then he says a little, just slightly further down, Israel's recent attacks against Iran's proxies will likely help bring about this prophesied shift within Syria. I mean, that is what we've been seeing this week. What an exciting start to this Week in Review show, where we're seeing Bible prophecy being fulfilled at a really, really rapid pace. I mean, okay, yeah, as you say, we don't know exactly all the twists and turns that we're going to see in Syria. I mean, we've also seen Bashar al-Assad himself kind of distance himself from Iran, as Mr. Flurry alluded to in that quote, and draw closer to these other allied states that are closer to Europe and closer to Germany, and potentially even, you know, make signals that he might be willing to switch sides. So, you know, we're not necessarily saying that he's going to be uprooted here, but I think certainly these events this week will play a role in this fulfilled prophecy. So, you know, we've got an excellent article in that Rise and Fall of Lebanon that you can look at right now about what is going on here that you can go and pull out and read. And that's in our latest Trumpet print edition. And you can watch that prophecy fulfill before your eyes. I mean, you probably should go and read that article pretty soon, because that might not be a forecast in another week or two. Who knows, like, how much this is changing. Maybe next Trumpet print will be able to have a section about that as fulfilled prophecy. I don't know. I don't want to set dates, of course, but certainly we're seeing some dramatic fulfilled prophecy there in Lebanon. And just, you know, keep watching what is happening in Syria and in Lebanon. It's going to play a big role in what will happen in Europe. And I might touch on that a little bit when I get to the Europe section. I also want, though, to go to Jeremiah first, because he's talking about a trend as well in Asia that is having a major effect in Europe. And one of the key big drivers of world news, Vladimir Putin, and some of what he's been up to. So good afternoon, or good morning, I guess, for where you are, Jeremiah. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thanks very much for having me.
So you're...
Yeah, so...
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, sure, yes. So a U.S. intelligence document has just been declassified, and this document sheds light on allegations of Russia systematically assassinating people in other countries who oppose Vladimir Putin. So this is it's a story that's not new to Russia watchers. The rates of Putin's critics who die by, you know, poisoning,
falling out windows,
or yes, falling out of windows, or all kinds of other mysterious deaths are incredibly high. It's almost become a joke at this point, just a morbid joke, because so many people die by these bizarre methods after they criticize or oppose Putin. So the broader story here is really not new, but the newly declassified documents do provide new evidence of the Kremlin's fingerprints all over some of these high profile killings, and specifically of Vladimir Putin's role in ordering those assassinations. The document highlights the case of one of Putin's enemies named Zelimkhan Yandarbayev. He was the former head of the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria until Putin ordered his death. His assassination happened in Qatar. And then the document also highlights the case of a Putin critic named Alexander Litvinenko. He was in a hotel in London, actually, when some of Putin's agents tricked him into drinking green tea that had been laced with polonium-210. So Litvinenko, just a really tragic case there. He spent about 2 weeks in the hospital as his body slowly broke down from this vicious poison until he died. It also talks about the death of Alexander Parapolichny and several others. Now, the document that was declassified, it is a little bit dated, having been written back in 2016. So it doesn't discuss any of the more recent of Putin's assassinations. But this overall trend of Putin's ruthlessness and evil, it is something that the Trumpet has been watching for many years. Back in 2017, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, he wrote an article that says, Putin is not just an authoritarian leader. This is a man with beastly power and with a beastly desire to rule the world. He is a vengeful, monstrous friend of the devil, with all sorts of anti-God policies. He is steeped in secrecy, deception, manipulation, aggression, intimidation, coercion, and force. And there's far more about him that we do not know. end quote. So, you know, Mr. Flory wrote that article there back in 2017, as I said, and he said that there was far more about Putin that we didn't even know at that time. And here we have this newly declassified intelligence published this week that does fill in some of what we didn't know before. This fills in some of the gaps and provides more evidence for what before was really only conjecture, just speculation that these were targeted assassinations ordered by Putin. But now we see his direct role in these killings that are happening outside of Russia. And of course, the events in Ukraine since that article was written also give us more abundant evidence of Putin's, what Mr. Flory termed, anti-God policies. So this article, it was from 2017, but it remains as relevant as ever now. And actually, I think takes on quite a bit of renewed relevance. And we can leave a link to that in the show notes for today's episode. It's called Should Donald Trump Trust Vladimir Putin?
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. And I think that's, you know, this is another example of where we've seen a lot of fulfilled prophecy, where that article will go through and you could read that. And it talks about how Vladimir Putin is mentioned in the Bible as a prophesied Russian leader in these end times. And Mr. Flory made specific forecasts about that during it was the mid-2010s, if we're going to call that decade that. And he talked about where you're going to see Vladimir Putin invade more former Soviet countries. And we've seen, we've absolutely seen that. We've seen more of that character, like you said, from him. I mean, Georgia has been very much in play all week with various different protests in the parliament. And a lot of trying to, that looks like they're trying to kind of steal the election potentially in Georgia, and well, there's all kinds of allegations. And I think this is a big part, another big part of the story that Mr. Flory has talked about is, okay, he himself is prophesied, but also that fear of Vladimir Putin is going to bring some major changes in Europe. That's something he's been saying for 10, 15 years. And I think this is where it ties into what Mihailo just talked about. You know, Europe, the refugee crisis of Syrian refugees flooding into Europe, that brought about massive changes. Like, if I'm a European prime minister right now, I'm terrified because of what is happening in Syria. Because this, like, with how much the migrant crisis transformed Europe last time around, what is going to happen if that hits again? But then this fear of Russia is another big thing. And, you know, you mentioned he's shadowy. He operates behind the scenes. There's maybe things that we don't know and that we find out years later. That does spread a lot of fear. You know, this week, one of the big talking points for Europe-Russian relations and news is this DHL plane that crashed into somebody's house in Lithuania. And there was a story a few weeks ago where Russia was apparently caught, or someone, probably Russia, was caught practicing blowing up DHL shipments, and they thought it might be a test run to detonate a shipment on a DHL plane, basically to carry out a terrorist attack. One of these shipments was discovered in Leipzig. Now you have a DHL plane that takes off from Leipzig and then crashes. That has a lot of people questioning, was Russia behind this? Was this some kind of accident? Was this some kind of Russian terrorist attack? Now, the latest that we're getting from the Lithuanian authorities is they're saying, well, no, we don't think this was sabotage. There's no sign that this was sabotage. This looks like it was an accident. I mean, if that's the case, it could be a coincidence, but and coincidences happen. We do get that. So, you know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I am not an expert on any of these kind of things, so I don't want to point a finger too much. My point is that if you act in this shadowy way, that does spread fear, because every time you get a plane crash like that, everyone starts to say, well, is it Russia? Every time you have questions about an election, like in Georgia, and I, again, haven't spent enough time with it, I don't to really stand out here on live YouTube and Twitter TV and point a finger and say, yes, I am certain that it was Putin behind it. But regardless, if you're doing that kind of thing, it spreads fear, it raises those questions. So I think in all of these different ways, you do have, this is spreading a lot of fear within Europe, the way that he is making these shadowy attempts. But I think there are some other articles that you wanted to talk about that you know, relate to this same kind of spreading fear within Europe.
Yes, that's right. And actually, before we move into those, just one final point about these assassinations regarding the topic of spreading fear, you know, Putin is not stupid. He knows that he could switch up his methods of killing people to give himself more plausible deniability. There are plenty of ways to make these kinds of deaths look far less suspicious and perhaps even natural. But instead, he intentionally uses the same methods over and over again, using nerve agents, for example, that only nation states have the ability to manufacture and deliver, or using defenestration over and over again, throwing people out of these windows. It's become almost a trope. But these are calling cards that Putin is using. He wants his enemies to know that it was him, because the whole point is to make sure that everyone fears him and knows that if they cross him, his government will hunt them down and kill them, and they'll kill them no matter where they are. If you're in the UK, it doesn't matter. If you're in the US, if you're in Qatar, it doesn't matter. His government agents will track you down and kill you. So I really think that the method of these assassinations is very significant, because it's designed to maximize the fear.
That's a really good point. Just before you move on, I mean, he tries to have his cake and eat it. Like, this is about you, okay, we can't be legally held responsible because we're not coming out and saying, yes, we did it, but we'll do it in such a way as everyone knows. So it spreads the fear without having any accountability. Anyway,
yes,
you were going to bring in some other stories.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, first I just wanted to go through a quick update of Russia's war on Ukraine. Last week on the episode, we spoke about the US and UK and France giving Ukraine permission to use some of their missiles on military targets inside of Russia. We spoke about how outraged the Russians were by this, just furious that anyone would dare to complicate their plans to crush and kill anyone they want to crush and kill. And we spoke about all the nuclear saber rattling from Russia that was happening, and about how that was almost certainly just bluster from Putin and his men. Well, this week, those Western missile strikes on Russia continued. There was even geolocated evidence of an American ATACM missile that destroyed one of Russia's vaunted S-400 missile defense systems. This was in Kursk, Russia. And that's a very advanced surface-to-air system that the Russians use, very expensive system. And this American missile, a Block 1 M-39 ATACM, it evaded the Russian system and destroyed it, along with the Russian officers who were operating that. And guess what? No nuclear World War III. Just as with the other dozens of times that Russia has had these temper tantrums and threatened fire and brimstone for anyone who complicates their imperialist ambitions. And then there was also a Russian airfield that was destroyed in Kursk, along with the warplanes that were there, apparently. So all of that was bad news, of course, for Russia. But at the same time, inside of Ukraine, the Russians continued to make gains this week, pushing incrementally deeper into Ukraine, especially around the Kharkiv region. And then Russia also managed to retake more of its territory in Kursk, Russia, where the Ukrainians have occupied territory there. So these gains, they are coming at a stunning cost to Russia in terms of manpower. But Putin is willing to withstand these soaring losses in order to improve his position as much as possible before Donald Trump takes power in the US in 52 days. And then Russia also made another of its massive attacks on Ukraine's power grid this week. This was on Thursday when Russia launched more than 200 missiles and drones at different parts of Ukraine's power grid. And several of these struck their targets. And apparently millions of Ukrainians are now in the dark and in the cold from that. So the war rages on, and the suffering from many, many people continues. Next up is a quick story, a little bit of good news out of China. This is about three American citizens who had been imprisoned in China for several years each on what were almost certainly false charges, fabricated charges. And on Wednesday, just in time for them to make it home to the US for Thanksgiving, they were released. So they have been reunited with their families after years of wrongful detention. So it is some good news. But on the other hand, we don't yet know what the US gave to China to secure the release of these three. So, you know, it's great to have them home, but you have to hope that the release didn't happen in an asymmetrical way that could weaken America's national security, as we see with a lot of prisoner exchanges and things like that. So we'll keep an eye on that for additional details to be published.
Yeah, it's hard to know. It could be, I wonder, maybe it's to do with, you know, they see Donald Trump and his tariff threats, and they're responding already to try and avoid that. So I don't know. We'll have to see on that. But thank you for that, Jeremiah. And that does bring us quite nicely to what I wanted to talk about with Europe, where, again, with all of these pressures that are on Europe, with Vladimir Putin threatening strikes on bases within EU member states. We saw that where November 21st, Russian foreign minister talked about attacking bases in Poland. There was a TV presenter quite close to the Kremlin that talked about threatening attacking bases in Cyprus. They're threatening US military bases, but they're threatening EU member states. And again, I agree with what you said, Jeremiah. I think it is Russia, that the fear of World War III was kind of overblown, and this was them trying to get people to back down. But still, that fear is real nonetheless, and Europe is going to respond to that fear as well as the United States. So with all of that pressure from Europe, with all of that, from Russia, with all of that pressure in the Middle East, we saw a lot more leaderless chaos going on in Europe. So this week we had the European Parliament approve the new European Commission, but it was the lowest level of support ever for a European Commission. So the parliamentary elections were in June. Taking half a year isn't actually that unusual for the European Commission to get its act together and kind of get approved, which I think that in itself gives you an idea for how quickly or slowly the European Union can react to things. But only 54% of parliament members voted for this commission, and that's the lowest level on record. There were big question marks right up until kind of the day of the vote as to whether it would get through because of disagreements within EU countries, within pan-European parties that are alliances of different European parties. It was very much a kind of botched compromise. So you've got a lot of weakness there. And then France, I think, has been some of the most dramatic political news in Europe this week, as you have this game of brinkmanship between the French Prime Minister Michel Barnier and the... They get called far right. I don't really like calling them far right, but the National Rally
Populist.
Or National Front. Sorry?
Populist.
Populist. I don't really like that term either. I mean, the thing with the National Front is some of their policies have also been far left. So fringe, non-mainstream. But anyway, they are they're kind of playing chicken. Michel Barnier and Marine Le Pen, where Barnier can force his budget through a reluctant National Assembly. So if you remember, if you think back to the summer, France had their election and basically it was one third far left, one third central, one third far right, if we're going to use that term for the National Rally, split three ways. And it can't get anything done with that three-way split. They really can't agree on anything. They kind of have this prime minister that is trying to get a budget through. And he can, the French constitution does allow him, it gives him ways to force the budget through, but then it gives the National Assembly ways to get rid of him. And so they're kind of playing chicken, where he's trying to force through the budget, and Marine Le Pen is saying, well, if you do that, we'll get rid of you of a prime minister. But if there is no budget, I mean, people are talking about kind of worst case government shutdown, where the government can't collect taxes, can't pay the bills, nation defaults on its debt. And of course, just as in the United States, when there's government shutdowns, there are various technical means that people talk about of getting around that. And will you see this worst case or won't you? The big takeaway, though, really is everywhere you look in Europe, surrounded by major crises, they don't know what to do. And you've got governments in chaos. Like Syria could be on the brink of exploding and sending millions more refugees in Europe's direction and completely overthrowing every European government and bringing about a revolution in political power. And everyone is completely consumed by infighting. Like Germany, they've got their new election coming up and everything in Germany is just consumed pretty much with that. They've also had a lot of bad economic news. That's been going on all this week as well, but maybe I'll touch on that in just a minute. So Germany is all consumed with infighting. France is consumed with this drama and there's attempts to arrest Marine Le Pen and all of this. They're completely falling apart. European Commission, more divided than ever and struggling to get the approval of the European Parliament. So nothing at all
that's looking any good in Europe in terms of being able to deal with these problems. And then I thought this was really interesting. This was a survey that was conducted, I think this was several months ago. It might have been in the spring that it was conducted, but it was published this week in Austria. It was designed to do a survey of all different kinds of views in Austria. But 1/3 of Austrians said, I would like to see a strongman at the head of this country who doesn't have to worry about a parliament. That is where this is leading, where nations, individuals see the crises building beyond their borders. They are afraid of nuclear war. They are afraid of Vladimir Putin using ICBMs in their country. They are afraid of migrants moving in and how that could transform their country, of how the Middle East falling apart would affect them. And they see a government that can't get anything together. And more people are saying, oh, I wish we just had a strongman in charge. You didn't have to worry about this squabbles in parliament. I think also surprisingly from this, it was from the Documentation Center of Austrian Resistance. 36% said they wouldn't want Jews in their neighborhood. 42% said they agreed that Israel's policy in Palestine is like that of the Nazis in the Second World War. And that's a shocking statistic. I think that's a reflection of just how much people have basically been brainwashed by the media. It's not remotely like the Nazis' policies in the Second World War. So at the same time, you're seeing Israel being demonized. You're seeing this spirit of anti-Semitism rising. This is a really important story to watch for in Europe. And I'd really encourage you. The Key of David this week is from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, and it's on exactly this subject. It's Germany's coalition government collapsed. You can get to that on our YouTube page. Actually, the Key of David has its own YouTube channel. If you're not subscribed to that and you're watching on YouTube, you can go subscribe, watch the Key of David. They come out every week. That's where you're hearing directly from Mr. Flurry, and he really lays out the importance of what is happening in Germany and how we need to watch that. And I think all of this news this week just underscores the importance of this trend that he's talking about there. Also, in that Trumpet magazine that you can see on the right if you're watching the stream there, there's an article in there that talks exactly about this. After Trump's victory, watch Germany. And that talks about the way that Germany's leadership is absolutely collapsing. And yeah, you see that spread all across Europe. And he begins that article saying, I believe recent events in Germany will in one way or another open the door for this strongman. This is a prophecy we must really pay attention to. So this is the rise of a German strongman in Europe. This is another really critical prophecy. This is one that we have been making for a long, long time. Herbert W. Armstrong was talking for decades about the rise of a strongman in Europe. He is so central to world events, and world events are going to move so far. I mean, they're already moving fast, but once he's on the scene, so much is going to change so quickly. And Europe, you can see, is crying out for this individual, and you can really see that happening very quickly. A couple of other stories I wanted to touch on just quickly before we make sure we get Andrew in before we finish the show. One is that we mentioned Mr. Flurry's article in that latest Trumpet print on Lebanon. And one of the things that he draws attention to in that article is Cyprus. That article is The Fall and Rise of Lebanon. But he talks about Cyprus, the role that Cyprus has always played as a stepping stone for Europe getting more involved in the Middle East. And so I thought it was really interesting that the Cypriot president was speaking at an economist summit last week on Thursday, and the foreign minister was as well. And they both spoke very strongly about their need for more Europe, for Europe's need to get stronger, for Europe's need to sort out this leadership problem and this division that they're plagued with and get more involved in Cyprus and the Middle East. So the president, he said, stability, welfare and security in the Eastern Mediterranean are inextricably linked to the stability and safety of the EU. He called for the EU to play a substantive role in the region with active involvement and close cooperation with regional partners such as Egypt, Jordan, and the Gulf states. He offered up Cyprus to, quote, act as a bridge between the EU and the region. He talked about the EU to help negotiate peace between Cyprus and the breakaway Turkish Cypriot Republic there in the north. The foreign minister, he warned that Europe risks becoming irrelevant in this whole discussion. You know, if you keep squabbling like this, you're just going to be irrelevant to what's happening in the Middle East. And we want more Europe involved. And like I said, Cyprus also, you know, they were threatened by Russia. Another reason for them to get Europe involved. So I thought it was really interesting. Both of these leaders did talk about the United States. They did talk about Britain, both of whom have a military presence on Cyprus and would be the powers that Cyprus traditionally looks to for protection. But they very strongly included the European Union in that. And I thought that is well worth paying attention to when you look at what Mr. Flurry has written and what he wrote in that trumpet print about the key role that Cyprus will play. And the other story I wanted to talk about briefly is just this economic news from Germany, where so much bad news for German manufacturing this week. So Bosch announced over the weekend cutting about 40,000 jobs in Germany. Another 10,000 employees would have their hours cut down from 40 hours a week to 38 to 40, down to 35. Volkswagen confirmed again that they'll be closing 3 factories, cutting thousands of jobs. This is the first time Volkswagen would ever have closed even a single factory within Germany in its 90-year history. And then ThyssenKrupp, this steel manufacturing giant, they announced plans to cut 40% of their workforce over the next 4 years. So they employ 27,000 people, and they plan on getting rid of 11,000. 5,000 they say they want to get rid of. They would lose their job by 2030. Another 6,000 they plan on basically spinning off or selling that parts of their company to other companies. So their jobs would be in jeopardy, but not necessarily losing them. And this points to another reason for Germany wanting long-term leadership. Like, their economic model is failing. Germany being this hub for cheap Russian energy and then this manufacturing superpower, they're not doing that anymore, and they're losing a whole lot of jobs. That is another reason for them to cry out for a strong leader. So that is another critical story to watch in Europe. And like I said, watch that Key of David. I think that's a great... They're fairly short programs, 20, 25 minutes, and that will give you a lot to see in what is happening in Europe and how that fits in with the overall prophetic trend. So, I mean, we're recommending quite a few different things. We'll try and note them down in the show notes. But if you do one thing, I would say go watch the Key of David for this weekend and get caught up on that critical story. If you do two things, watch that and then subscribe to the Trumpet Print Magazine. You can go to our website. You can get that absolutely for free. We're happy to send that anywhere around the world. No strings attached if you just click the sign up button on our website. Don't worry, Andrew, this is not me finishing up the show. I have still managed to save a little bit of time for you. So what's been going on in the United States this week?
Yeah, I think we had one big story almost sneak through the cracks, right? Just a couple hours before the nation took off for Thanksgiving, where you had a federal appeals court in Texas rule that the Biden-Harris administration indeed cannot walk behind the Texas Border Patrol and cut and remove the barbed wire that they lay down.
Now, yeah, I'm glad you're bringing this up.
For a little background.
Like, this was a huge story over the summer, and I've seen nothing about this.
Yeah, we actually had a cover story on the Trumpet for April 2024, is that basically what happened is, since the Biden administration had been allowing over 2 million illegals a year to cross into the United States and was doing nothing to stop it, the government of Texas decided to go unilateral and said, it's like, well, if the federal government's not going to enforce the U.S. border, we're going to protect the Texas border, because Texas also has a border with Mexico. And so Texas went in and started laying down barbed wire to, like, keep these millions of illegals from coming over, in which case the Biden administration sued. The Biden administration sent their people out, and instead of enforcing the border, they spent their time and money and resources cutting and removing the barbed wire that Texas was laying down. So you basically had the state of Texas and the federal government, like, at war with each other, where one was laying down barbed wire, one was cutting it up, one was trying to keep the illegals in Mexico, the other one was trying to let them into the United States. It really got to a pretty fever pitch legal lawsuit until the Supreme Court came down and said that, well, they issued a stay saying the Biden administration can remove the barbed wire until a lower court has time to look at this. And so we've had hundreds of thousands of illegals pour over the border over the summer until just hours before Thanksgiving. The lower court finally had time to look at this and said, it's like, okay, well, we are going to allow, we're going to stop the Biden administration from removing this barbed wire and allow Texas to start enforcing border security, which I don't know if the election of Trump had any influence on these judges' decision, because now, come January 20th, the federal government wasn't going to be cutting the barbed wire anyway. They were going to be helping the Texans defend the border. But now, because of at least this Thanksgiving ruling, the Texans will be allowed to defend the U.S. border with Mexico for the next 3 months or so, until the Trump administration comes into place and starts helping them. So that's an ability, a gift to the nation, that we're actually able to start defending our border 3 months early. We don't actually have to wait for the Trump administration to take office. The Texans can fill in the gap for the next 3 months until the Trump administration does come about.
And the other way that we can, I guess, get that border is defended a bit early as well, as we had the announcement about tariffs this week, didn't we, from Donald Trump? I think he posted on Truth Social, was it 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico unless they get the border under control? And we saw a little bit of movement or response from those countries, didn't we, on that?
A bit, because the way tariffs work in the United States is, if you want to do a blanket tariff as an economic policy, you need approval from Congress.
But if it's for national security reasons, yeah.
In a national security threat, the president can enact tariffs by executive order. So Trump used the fentanyl crisis. He said that China's shipping fentanyl to Mexico and also to Canada, and then it's crossing the Mexican and Canadian borders into the United States. So he was going to put a tariff on all three nations unless they did something to stop the fentanyl crisis. So 60% tariff on China, 25% on both Mexico and Canada. Now, those, obviously, he's not the president yet, so he can't make an executive order. The tariff, he will have to make that executive order when he comes to office. He just said he was going to. And sheerly the threat of saying he was going to enact such a tariff, Justin Trudeau from Canada called him within 2 hours. The Mexican president took a little longer. I think it may have been later that day or maybe even the next day to call Donald Trump. But Trump said he had a very nice conversation with both the Prime Minister of Canada and the President of Mexico. And both, I think Trudeau and Canada seemed more willing to stop the fentanyl crisis. The Mexican president did a bit more of like self-defense, saying that, like, well, we've been doing everything we can already, but we'll keep doing everything we can. But definitely seemed like there's some willingness that the president of Mexico realizes, unless they do something to stop the fentanyl, which, and stopping the fentanyl trafficking means shutting down the border crisis, they're going to get slapped with a 25% tariff. So there's now consequences. Under the Biden administration, there was no consequences. You had all these people from Guatemala and Central America and Venezuela and other nations coming to Mexico, and the Mexicans don't want them to stay. So they said, just keep on walking and get up to the United States. Now that Trump's and the federal courts are saying that, like, we're putting barbed wire on the border, we're slapping you with a 25% tariff until this migrant crisis stops, now it's actually in Mexico's national interest to stop the border crisis. Because if they can't cross the United States, they have to stay in Mexico, which the Mexicans don't want. So Trump's really done a pretty good job of, like, showing it that, like, the Mexicans aren't going to help us out of the goodness of our hearts. We need to make in their interest to stop the border crisis. And it's in their interest to avoid a 25% tariff. And it's in their interest to avoid having a migrant crisis of their own. And so you could definitely see some big movement there. It's interesting, from a prophetic standpoint, I think there's Well, one, just the prophecy we've highlighted so many times from Amos 7 about this end time Jeroboam figure or Donald Trump being supported by a king's chapel and a king's court. Because for a long time, the US court system seemed very against Donald Trump. And then just in the past year, they ruled that he could run for office. They ruled that he was immune from prosecution for constitutional actions he took in office. They ruled that these executive agencies can't just make up laws themselves apart from Congress, which has really opened the door for Elon Musk and the Doge program to come in here and do some propose some big spending cuts and some big firings possibly as well from a lot of these deep state agents. Now they're even making rulings, I guess in this case it was a federal court, not necessarily the Supreme Court, really backing up Trump's plan to do some border security. So that's really a dramatic fulfillment of this prophecy of like a king's court supporting this Jeroboam figure.
Now, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. We can add that to our list of fulfilled prophecies that we've been talking about today.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and there's also probably like in Isaiah about the Isaiah 1 and verse 7 about the stranger within your gates rising up and burning your cities. So we'll see how successful Trump is. I don't think he's going to be extremely successful in deporting the illegals that are already here. If he deports all the strangers, then these prophecies about strangers rising up within your gates and burning your cities with fire could not be fulfilled. But even if he's not as successful at deporting the ones that are already here, it definitely seems like he's already had great success in stopping more illegals from coming. About 10 million snuck into the nation under Biden's watch, and it might be hard to undo that damage. But it looks like we're not, come January, we're not going to be seeing what we've been seeing for the past 4 years, where 200,000 or 300,000 new illegals show up every single month.
Great.
They're going to get some wire on the border, and then the Texans and then the Mexicans are going to try to avoid this tariff.
Well, thank you for that story. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we wrap this up?
I think for my other stories, the tariff ones were the big thing I wanted to talk about, in addition to the Supreme Court or the court case angle, is that we've already seen movement on Mexico, but you've also got these 25% tariff threats on Canada and China. Which could bear some other fruits, because I think Trump actually wants a tariff on China. I don't think he wants one on Canada. In addition to the fentanyl problem, there's been disputes between the Canadian and American auto industry. And after Trump made that tariff threat, one of the big Canadian auto spokesmen came out and said that he thinks the important thing is for the U.S. and Canada to present a united front against China. He said so they... He thinks they should be able to hash out a new trade deal, a new trade deal between Canada and China that gives them more favorable terms on the auto industry and be able to avoid this tariff. So far, and I don't think Trump's announced too many tariffs that are going to stick, but he seems to have gotten a lot of leverage with the threat of it, just the threat of putting a tariff on Mexico and China and Canada. Is already bearing some fruits that, like, we will see some more favorable auto trade deals and some more favorable immigration security as these nations, which Canada, with Mexico and China, are two biggest trade partners. So they definitely have a vested interest to make sure we get the border crisis resolved and contribute to a temporary resurgence in the United States in order to avoid that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I think that is about all we have time for today's Trumpet World. Good job we're not still called Trumpet Hour, because otherwise we would be over time. But thank you so much for those of you that were able to join us live for this experiment. If you joining us live, if anyone else, if you want to give us some feedback, we're still experimenting with this. That feedback is useful. We may well make changes based on what you tell us. If you say, oh, well, I mean, we are a little bit limited for this week in review show, but maybe other days if there's a different time that we should look at experimenting with or anything like that, you know, give us your thoughts. You can get in touch, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com, or you can leave us a comment on YouTube, Rumble, or Twitter. I guess you don't leave comments, but leave a reply, something like that, and we will definitely take a look at that. We've given you a rundown of quite a lot of important prophetic stories, but it is very much a rundown. It's a brief summary of how the news events of this week tie into Bible prophecy. If a lot of this is new to you, though, we really encourage you to dig in, to prove this for yourself. Don't just take our word for it when we say, well, Psalm 83 says that Lebanon is going to move over here, or Amos 7 says that the Supreme Court is going to do this or that. Prove it for yourself. This is too important for you to take someone else's word from. Don't believe me. Don't believe any one of these panelists. Believe your Bible. And you can go to our website. We have a whole big catalog of literature that you can use, that you can read to prove this for yourself. We mentioned the Key of David program. I mentioned that again. That's a great place to go to see another video on what is happening within Germany and our Trumpet print magazine that you can get on our website. Well, thank you so much for Isaac Lorenz for helping getting everyone set up over in the States, and for George Haddad in the hot seat live. A lot more pressure, a lot more stress on him, at least for this hour or so when we do go live. But it's been pretty much flawless, I think, from a technical perspective. So thank you very much to George. And we will be back with our regular show on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.